Welcome to Offscript, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner-Kent, Senior Editor, and I'm here with...
Susie Evans, I'm the Managing Editor.
Deep Tran, Assistant Editor.
On this episode, we're excited we have an interview with James McNeil of Contemporary American Theater Festival, and that's a little later in the show. And we'll come back later and give our recommendations of things that we think you should read, see, or think about. But let's start off just a little talk about one of the big stories we broke on americantheater.org, our new website, was the leadership change, changing of the guard at Steppenwolf, the Chicago Theater. Susie, we were all on that story, but then Susie, you talked to Martha Levy, David Hawkinson, the outgoing, in all senses, artistic director and executive director. So just tell me what this was a big surprise, but it does seem to have been in the works for a while and pretty deliberate and well-planned. What is there to say about this?
Well, the way American Theater kind of broke that story is Steppenwolf hosted a big press conference that morning, which we weren't invited to because it was held in Chicago, and Deep saw on Twitter from Time Out Chicago theater critic and editor Chris Fire that there was breaking news that Anna D. Shapiro was going to be replacing Martha Levy as the Steppenwolf Artistic Director at the end of the 2014-15 season. So we immediately, you know, wrote it up and broke the news. I think we were second to the Chicago Tribune. And then that day, I was lucky enough to get on the phone with David Hawkinson, who is the executive director who's going to be stepping down in January 2015, and David M. Schmitz is going to be taking over for him. So I talked with David Hawkinson and Martha Levy about the decision. I think it was in the afternoon. And it was something that Martha said that they've been talking about since January, had been in the works. You know, they'd kept it pretty quiet. Not a lot of people knew about it, but they had carefully planned it. And the impetus that they kind of came to from it was this idea of they were doing this campus expansion project. And it was a project that's not fully funded yet. It's a project that's going to take, you know, 5 years and maybe, and then what David told me in the interview is 2 more years to learn how to run. And so they really saw this as a long-term project, and they need some quote-unquote, like, new energy to come in and reinvigorate the organization. Right. And so Martha had seen Anna as her, you know, successor for a long time. Anna had been getting a lot of, you know, attention, offers from other companies, a lot of big gigs in New York, her most recent being This Is Our Youth, which started at Steppenwolf and is now on Broadway. She's also doing
the Larry David show.
Fish in the Dark, yeah. So she has a lot going on, and so... There were times when Martha came to her before asking if it was time, and she kind of said no. She still was working on her projects, and this was kind of a time in Anna's career where she decided that she really wanted to make her roots in Chicago, where her family is, and, you know, take on a position. And there are, you know, very few roles at theaters that are worthy enough of Anna D. Shapiro, and I think Artistic Director of Steppenwolf is one of them.
Right, and Martha's been there 19 years, is that right?
19, I think it'll be 20 in 2015. She started in 95.
And David Hawkinson, 11 or so.
11 years, so he and Martha have worked together for 11. And David M. Schmitz, I believe, has been there for 10. I think he's been there for 10.
Well, I was impressed by, I think when there's Artistic Director changes, some of them go smoothly, some there's a good succession plan for, sometimes the board is involved in good and bad ways. But I was impressed that there wasn't a national search. There wasn't an idea, let's get some hot person from New York, director from New York. Of course, Anna is sort of a hot director in New York, but she's an ensemble member, and they basically hired from within people that they brought up through the company. I was impressed by that. I don't think every theater has a succession plan that goes as smoothly, ostensibly, as this one.
Or pre-planned, even.
But it was planned, yeah.
Because usually someone usually... announces they're stepping down, and then they search for an artistic director throughout their final season.
Well, Martha said something that was very interesting to me when we talked. She said, first and foremost, artistic leadership always has come from within the company, which is kind of proven to be true based on their artistic directors. Always have been ensemble members. But this is really the first time where they've gotten executive leadership from within. And Martha credited it to David Hawkinson kind of creating a mentorship program and really mentoring David Schmitz over the past 10 years and really kind of not choosing him as a successor, but knowing that this was a smart guy who was going to be an attractive candidate for an executive position, whether it was at Steppenwolf or somewhere else. And it just so happened that it lined up. I mean, the point that David made, which is very interesting, which I think you're speaking to, Rob, in terms of this larger issue in the community, is this idea of succession. And the issue that so many theaters face now is that what he said to theater's benefit is they are creating these, you know, very specific missions and very specific work environments in their companies that sometimes it's hard to come to as an outsider. And so it's not as easy as it used to be to do that, which is both a benefit to the art form and a detriment in terms of looking for executive leadership. Because I don't know if a lot of companies have a mentoring program in place or a way of finding leadership from within the company. And if they don't, you know, sometimes they're getting great candidates who might not understand their way of working.
Right, right. No, it's. I have to say, I'm not kissing ass here. I think Steppenwolf has over the past number of years that I've watched their company, they don't just do, you know, great plays that we want to see and nurture great artists. I really feel like they have their management house in order. They also have been at the forefront of a lot of ideas. Their teen council. I've just been impressed with the institutional side of Steppenwolf. They seem to be leading in that way, much like Oregon Shakespeare and a couple other companies I could think of who have had leaders. I think probably, although people haven't said it aloud too much enough, which is something Chris Jones brought up, it's Martha Levy who's been instrumental in that, and diversifying the company as well. That's been a big push of hers. So, you know, I look forward to where Steppenwolf is going, but it's great to see where it's been.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that. I mean, when I spoke with David, he said one of his biggest highlights from his time there is they got the Wall Street Journal's best small workplaces. So they really have created a great, work ethic and work environment for the company. And then in terms of Martha being an institution and kind of bringing in younger people into the ensemble and more cultural diversity, that's something she also spoke to in her interview about how, you know, they pegged, this is what Chris Jones said in his piece, they pegged this change as a generational change, you know, bringing in younger leadership. And, you know, Chris made an interesting point that, you know, Anna's not that much younger than Martha. Martha is not the same age as David. David is more of a retirement age. Martha's, you know, in her late 50s. So sure. It's an interesting point he makes. But Martha did talk in the interview about how, you know, it's always the decision of the ensemble members whether or not they're going to bring on new artists, but they are aware of this need to bring on more young people and bring on more cultural diversity, and maybe that's something that we're looking forward to with this leadership change.
I hope so.
It's also a good thing just because there's always a talk about, well, at all these theater conferences about how there's not very many women in executive leadership roles, especially in bigger houses like the Steppenwolf. And so it's just great to see like this changing of the guard, but it's from one established female artistic director to a very established female director.
Yeah, I like that. In fact, one thing Chris pointed out, and I think this is really true, the stereotype that Steppenwolf was a macho company and that it was defined by that was really has been belied for so long. I can't give all the credit to Martha, but I think that has a lot to do with her. You still have some guys who are part of the company and plays like that, but it's a much more diverse aesthetic than people give it credit for, I think.
Well, another interesting thing that's coming with, you know, Anna taking this role is something I talked with Martha about is almost all of the artistic directors have been actors, mainly. Right. It's been an actor-run company based on ensemble. Anna's the first one, I think Martha named H.E. Baucus as someone who was a director.
In the founding, like, I think when they started, there was a director who directed, which is what you usually mean when you start a company. So yeah. There was a director, H.E. Baucus, who most people don't know much about, including myself. But yeah, after that, it was run by
all actors. So Anna's the first director only, which I think is going to be interesting to see how it, you know, shapes the work at the company.
Do you think she'll keep doing the Broadway directing gigs?
I think she will, and I mean, I haven't spoken with Anna, but Martha seemed to think that she wouldn't give up that part of her career. I mean, Diane Paulus still directs in New York all the time, and she's an artistic director of ART, so.
And Belle Rouse just made her Broadway debut as a director.
That's true.
And Carrie Perloff is directing off-Broadway right now. She's artistic director at ACT.
I do think that theater directors have a choice at some point in their careers whether to be freelance or to run an institution. And it sounds like others of them have tried to have both as best as they can. Sometimes it has to do with their family situation. I know that was the case with Bill. And I think it works out for other directors in different ways. I think it was in your piece, Martha said that Anna wanted to have a home.
Well, Anna has young children. I don't know how old her kids are, but she has twins, I believe, a boy and a girl. And, you know, she has young kids. They're based in Chicago. That's the reason I think most of the rehearsals for Of Mice and Men, which, you know, she directed on Broadway with James Franco and Chris O'Dowd, happened in Chicago.
Chicago, okay.
And so she has been able to, you know, balance her Broadway products with that. She was able to bring big stars like James Franco to Chicago to rehearse so she could be near her family. I don't know if she's done it for all of her projects, but she had This Is Our Youth at the Steppenwolf first, where she really got to work on it. So she does it as a family. I mean, her husband, Ian Barford, who's an actor, is starring on Broadway right now in Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. So I'm sure there's some juggling that happens in her family, but she does want to be based in Chicago based on what Martha said. And so this is an opportunity for her to be more there. But that being said, I don't think that she's going to lose her profile in New York, because that's something that helps the theater. You know, Anna's connections with people and her knowledge of the community as a whole, you know, serves Steppenwolf well, even though, as Martha said, her goal in leading Steppenwolf is to, you know, serve the Chicago audiences and the Steppenwolf mission.
Right. It's interesting how what Steppenwolf is known, or maybe it's known for, maybe not infamous for, how many people are members who aren't based in Chicago or have bi-coastal careers or not even tri-coastal, but who work in all the three big markets as actors and directors. But I'm amazed, I'm impressed by how much they still feel their roots back there, you know?
They do. I mean, it has a lot of national attention on it as a company, but I feel like Martha said this in the interview, and I have to credit it for her, that part of that means they stick to their guns, and that's why it's been... That's why they've gotten successful, because I guess their guns are good.
Right. So, Deep, you did an interview last week with the head of Contemporary American Theater Festival. Just tell us a little bit about that before we go into the interview.
Sure. He's actually the managing director of Contemporary American Theater Festival, which is a summer theater based in West Virginia. We published Gideon's Knot in December 2012 by John Adams, which got its world premiere at CATF, as they like to call it. And basically, the reason I talked to him was, it's something that we'd like to call out-of-towners now.
Sure.
Or like visitors who come from out of town to the CCG office, since we host so many meetings and have a lot of artists in these walking through these halls. And James was here because a play that they mounted, they had a world premiere this past summer, is getting done at 5959 in the Upper West Side, and it's called... Upper East Side. I'm not good with directions right now.
The E in 5959 is East.
East, yeah, 59, East 59, which is really good when you're trying to figure out where it's located.
It's really hard to get to.
You're addressing the name.
Exactly. And the play is by Thomas Gibbons, and it's also getting a National New Play Network Rolling World premiere.
So, here's the title. What was it?
It's called Uncanny Valley.
Uncanny Valley.
And it's about robots.
Awesome.
Cool.
So, I talked to James about that and about what CATF looks for in their new play development. So, for any playwrights who's interested, this is a good interview.
Great. We'll be back afterwards to give our recommendations.
Hi, and welcome back to Off Script. I'm sitting here with James McNeil, the managing director of Contemporary American Theater Festival in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. James is in town for a premiere of a CATF play at 59E59 Theater on the Upper East Side. That's the 50. It always confuses me what area of town
kind of
that
no
is.
No man's land over there. It's just right on the cusp of a lot of different neighborhoods. A
couple blocks, you know, east of the Apple Store is probably how most folks know where it is.
Yes. Yeah, so, well, that is a very touristy area.
But a beautiful theater.
Yes,
absolutely beautiful theater.
No, I love the work there, and I love that they just...
Yeah, they're fascinating. I think they're in around their 10th year, and their mission is really to give a stage opportunity to regional theaters across the country. And so you get invited to bring a show in, and they take care of a lot of sort of the things you wouldn't want to take care of if you were coming into the city for a short run. So the marketing, the publicity, the front of house operations. But they really are all about encouraging the regional theaters to have an opportunity off Broadway, and that was the situation that was presented to us, and we're thrilled to be there. They've been absolutely terrific.
Fantastic. So how did, well, the play is Uncanny Valley by Thomas Gibbons, and it's currently running.
It opened up on October 2nd, mm-hmm. and it runs through October 26th. So we had a 4-week run, performances Tuesday to Sunday.
Mm-hmm. And how did 5959 reach out to you about transferring this over? What's the process behind that?
One of those sort of great opportunities that just kind of, you know, not fell in our lap, but kind of, I think, the stars aligned. We were producing, you know, Uncanny Valley this summer in Shepherdstown during our 24th season. It was one of five plays in rotating repertory. And the opening weekend, Tom Gibbons' agent, Susan Gurman, came down and saw the show and thought, you know, the production was solid and that we'd done a good job with the play, and came back to New York and did what I think all great agents do, is she started shopping around a little bit and seeing what was going on. And she reached out to 5090s 59 and said, there's this great show going on down in West Virginia. I think you guys might really like it. And so they contacted us. We had a couple conversations. As it turns out, they had a slot open here in October in their 98-seat space, which is the Theater B. And the venue we were using for this show down in Shepherdstown, we have three venues, but this play was actually in our smallest one, which is a 99-seat theater, that the stage was within 2 feet of the exact same size in Shepherdstown and what they have up here in New York at Theater B. So it was just perfect. And within a few days, we made the decision that we were going to raise the money and come and bring the show to New York with our cast and crew. And it's just sort of been a whirlwind for the last couple months making that happen.
Mm-hmm. And we were talking about this earlier, so what was the process of how long did it take you, when did you get here, and how long did it take you to set everything up?
Well, you know, it's extraordinary. Today is Tuesday, so last mm-hmm. Sunday, we loaded up a 26-foot Penske truck in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, with all the sets, the costume, lighting equipment. There's a huge table device, which is very mm-hmm. integral to the play. It got loaded on there. And sent it to New Jersey to spend the night at a hotel right outside the city. And then we loaded up a 11-passenger van with the cast that we brought down to Shepherdstown for a couple of days of brush-up. Stage manager Peggy McCowan, my colleague, who's the associate producing director at CATF, who really coordinated all of this transfer from a production standpoint. And a couple other folks. They came up to New York Sunday. Monday morning at 8 a.m. when 5090-59 would let us in the door, we were there. Installed the entire set, and when you see the show, and I hope people will see the show, they'll see it's actually a pretty elaborate set for this small space. Mm-hmm. Did tech, you know, light, sound, video the next afternoon, 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the actors came in, did some spacing rehearsal. Wednesday, we did a 10 out of 12 tech. Thursday, we previewed. And we officially, in our mind, we opened the play on Sunday night and had a lot of donors and friends come up from all over to see the show and support us. But yeah, it was 6 days, and I was joking around, and then we rested. But and now we're sort of, hopefully we'll move into the normal performance mode for the next 3 weeks. But it's just, you know, it's a real shout out to our crew and the folks that came together, just worked around the clock to make it happen. And, you know, looking back, you go like, why did we think this was a good idea to try to pull this off in that short period of time? But that's the beauty of theater. We managed to.
Mm-hmm. And so for our listeners who aren't familiar with the play, it's the National New Play with mm-hmm. Network Rolling World Premiere,
correct.
And it played at CATF and also at Interact Theater Company in Philly, at San Diego Repertory Theater in California, and at Capital Stage Company in Sacramento.
It will be. It hasn't gone there yet. Yeah, okay. We started with us in Shepherdstown this
mm-hmm.
summer. It's had this little, you know, a divergent pit stop here to New York. And then San Diego and Philly, they'll be doing it, I think, in March, April of the spring of 2015, and then Capital Stage after that. So, yeah, at least has four different places lined up, which is great for the play.
Right. Well, now five.
Yeah. Well, now if you count this, absolutely.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And so, can you tell us a little bit about, like, a quick synopsis on what's the...
It's this really extraordinary play. It begins... Well, I'll get a little background. The playwright, Tom Gibbons, was sitting in his dentist's office reading an article in National Geographic about Bina 48. And Bina 48 is this sentient robot that has facial recognition you can have a conversation with. Just a real fascinating advancement in technology and in modern robotics. Incidentally, was actually funded by Martine Rothblatt, who was just on the cover of New York Magazine a couple weeks ago as the richest female CEO in the country. And it's modeled off of her partner, whose also name is Bina. At any rate, he saw this article. It's really inspired to, let's write a play about this. And so this play is set in the near future, and it imagines a time when the technology allows human beings to download their memories into a robot.
in the pursuit of immortality. It's absolutely a beautiful place. So it's about that. It's not sci-fi, though maybe it sounds like that. It's really not. It's about, like anything, it's about human relationships. It's, you know, mother-child. It's about the letting go of your creation and to the great world. I mean, Tom, the playwright, will talk about, you know, for him, you know, his son was going off to college. And so this was very much almost his empty nest moment of his life, too. So it's got a lot of different things going on. It's,
And so would you ever download your memory into a robotic body?
It's so interesting. We actually brought Bina, 48, to Shepherdstown this summer. She gets her own plane ticket. She lives in Vermont. She came down, and she's housed with a foundation called the Terrorism Foundation that's that works with this. And they work with a lot of this sort of, it's called the Life Knot Group. And they do a lot of this type of work where you can actually today go on and start putting your memories into these permanent databases, so that in the future, if the technology is there, potentially, you could download. But me personally, no, I don't think I would.
And so what was it like kind of interacting with her? Was it also like an Uncanny Valley kind of scenario where did it seem quite...
She's a difficult conversation. I think I don't think that's speaking out of turn. But we actually brought her down to... We do this weekly during the festival lecture series. And so she was actually one of our lecturers. And she came and spoke to, I don't know, we were sold out, over 200 people at this event during the festival. And she took questions from the folks in the audience. She, you know, she talked about herself, her thoughts on the world. But what was most fun for us internally was before we did that event, we actually brought the actors over and Tom Gibbons, the playwright, and they actually interviewed Bina, which we captured on video. We filmed them interviewing Bina. And like I said, she's a little bit of a tough talk sometimes. I mean, she sometimes goes off on tangents. But it's, you know, obviously it's not finite yet. It's not, you know, hasn't been perfected, this technology. But it doesn't seem that impossible either. And it's a little bit eerie, you know, what we maybe are trying to achieve. And the question is, do we really want to achieve it?
What attracted CATF to this particular play? Because you can choose from NNPN's database.
Well, I mean, NNPN, you know, it's interesting. We took this play to NNPN. We just joined the National New Play Network. This was our first year as a core member. So this play actually came to us not attached to that at all. This play was one of the 100+ that Ed Herendeen, our founder and producing director, reads every fall. And it was submitted, of course, by Susan Gurman, the literary agent I referenced earlier. And so he read the play, and I can remember it. It's almost been a year now that this play has been in our life. But so it was about last October, November, and I can remember Ed grabbing Peggy and myself and bringing us in and saying, this play is fantastic. I think it's something I really want to do in the season next year. And we sat down and we read it immediately, just the three of us right there in the office. And it was because it was thoughtful. It had a lot going on in terms of sort of the intellectual pursuit of the play. And yet, at the end of the day, it was also very engaging and moving and about relationships, but in a different sort of lens. So I think all three of us, as soon as we finished reading it around the table, we thought, we're absolutely want to do this play. But I went to San Diego for the National New Play Network annual showcase that they do and sort of told folks, hey, we're doing this play. Anybody wants to get on board for the Rolling World premiere, we'd love that, but we're doing it no matter what. And then a couple other theaters came on, and it's been great because we've been able to sort of collaborate with those theaters. For us, we were the first ones to do it, so we had to figure out a lot of things. There's a lot of sort of stage magic that happens in the first 25 or so pages of the script, and we had to figure out how we were going to pull that off without being a detriment to the story, without being a detriment to the movement of the play. But we do have to build this robot, but he's not really a robot. He's actually a human in real life. So you know, we really had to figure that out. But it's been a great opportunity working with NNPN, and they've been wonderful supporters of this. And we're just thrilled that this play, you know, our production obviously that got to came to New York, and that's great for everybody involved. But that the play itself is guaranteed to have three more stops. Is great for Tom.
Well, I mean, a good amount of our listeners are theater artists, and so how did there was this, like, the first 25 pages, as you said, it's a blackout, and then it's just his head, and it's a blackout, it's his head and a torso, and a head and another arm. And so how do you navigate? Mm-hmm. What was the trickery behind that?
Well, it took a lot of different thoughts. We actually consulted with one of the illusionists for Penn & Teller and sort of talked about like some, you know, black magic sort of concepts and how they do sort of illusions in that big thing. And a lot of those involve mirrors, which we learned. Mm-hmm. And the problem with mirrors was that they, surprise, surprise, reflect. And so it could limit the movement of the other actor, because Julian, the robot, obviously is stationary. He's on top of a table. His head is just there on top of the table. So there's a lot of pressure on Claire, or in this case, Barbara Kingsley's, to really be driving each scene, because she's the one who actually has her legs and can move around. So we didn't want to prevent her from being able to do crosses on the stage. So then we kind of, you know, brought our terrific TD in, Josh Frashesur, in, and he just started trying to figure out table prototypes that we could lock Alex into and have it on this sort of scissor system that can lift him up. And then we worked with our costume designer, Therese Brooke, on what type of costume to put on that so that you wouldn't see his arms. And then, but he could quickly pull his arms out, and then bring himself up on this little scissor lift and have it all happen in the matter of a blackout. Mm-hmm. And there's a hydraulic system. I mean, it's way more complicated than I can even begin to understand, you know, but it's got hydraulics. There's all these sorts of things going on, but mostly, you know, it's wonderful mechanics going on, and then absolute will by Alex, because he just has to hold his body absolutely still. And one of the interesting things that I remember him saying in a talk back this summer in Shepherdstown, which is really obvious, maybe I'm just sort of not very smart sometimes, but when he said it, it absolutely blew my mind, that the biggest challenge for him in this play, other than the physicality of it, is that robots don't make mistakes. You know, so if you're watching a human actor playing a human, the audience will be automatically forgiven of just the little tics that we do as humans, if we just sort of tie our tongue up a little bit or hum or whom or whatever it might be. A robot doesn't do that. Mm-hmm. So there's so much pressure on him to be so precise throughout the play. And he just nails it.
Mm-hmm. Now, like you're saying that, and I recall reading in the script that he has to learn how to blink. Yeah. Otherwise, it looks a bit odd. And so exactly. For the actor, like, how do you not... Right. Blink like the first 5 minutes of a play.
Yeah, I mean, you think about, oh God, it's a person playing a robot. How painful could that be, right? Alex has this absolute subtlety through it, and he watched a lot of videos and watched a lot of these other robots that actually are out there being built right now as we speak. And to watch his transformation is so subtle up towards the end, where you barely notice that he's not a human. But it's still there in a couple of very critical moments where you start to see that he's still there. But yeah, I mean, he just had to be very, you know, I think he just comes in so focused and has to constantly be not just thinking about what his motivation is in any given moment, but also how is his physical body coming across. And he just is, it's absolutely a joy to watch these two actors work. It truly is. I just love it.
Mm-hmm. And for this, I mean, for this transfer, like, what does, I guess the big question is, like, what does it mean for CATF? Mm-hmm. Are there going to be more in the future, or is it...
Well, we'll find out. We'll see how this goes. I mean, it's always been part of our strategic plan, you know, to not only, you know, import artists and audiences into West Virginia and produce new work and produce the next generation of American theater artists and the next canon for the American theater, but also to export our work. And in the past, we have a long history of our plays, the plays that we've premiered in Shepherdstown going on and being produced all across the country, off-Broadway, you know, turned into films, off-Broadway, what have you. But this is the first time we've ever packaged our own production and brought it up. And for us, it was, you know, I mean, it's hard from a sort of infrastructural standpoint because we were just coming out of our season. But it was such a great opportunity to be able to come up and introduce to New York, the industry, our work. For a lot of folks who maybe haven't been to West Virginia to see what we do every summer. And hopefully, you know, it just gives Tom, the playwright, you know, a little extra opportunity to be seen as well. Because our goal every year, the most important thing to us, is that the playwrights that come to CATF for the 5 plays that we produce, that they all leave Shepherdstown with a better script than which they arrived. And that is always our goal. Mm-hmm. This is sort of an extension of that. I know that Tom has a better script than when we began. I'm sure he feels that way. The production has helped that.
And it's a solid production that's coming to New York, and who knows what the opportunity will bring to him, to this play, to those actors. And then for us, you know, it's just extra visibility. You know, maybe we'll pick up a few extra audience members. Will people make the trek? We're only 4.5 hours from New York. Maybe more folks from the industry will come down and see what we're doing. But really for us, it was, why not? We love this play. It's what we do. We produce new plays. This is what we're passionate about. And we get to do it under the big lights of New York. So that's why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe we printed Gideon's Knot, which was originally produced at CATF, and then it was produced out on the country, including at 5959, mm-hmm. which was not your production.
Not our production.
Right.
No. I think it had about 15 productions in the past year.
Yes, yes. I think I talked to Jana for another story I wrote, and she says she's so tired of that play.
It's everywhere. I mean, and that, but you know, that play, we're so proud. I just saw Jana. She came Sunday night to our opening. I just saw Jana, and we're just so proud of her, that play. But it is the perfect example of what we're all about at CATF. It was a play that was out there. It's not like other theaters didn't have it, and nobody had committed to producing it. And Ed read it. He got it from New Dramatists, and read it and said, I absolutely am totally compelled to do this play. Got a great cast. He directed that production, and it blew the socks off of our audience. People were just so moved by it. And you know, it was great that it got published in American theater, so a lot of other theaters across the country got to see it, read the script, know that it could be done and received well, and then went on to have whatever it was, 14, 15 productions around the country. It was, you know, the finalist, semi-finalist, or the whatever they call it, the for the Atka Steinberg Award, mm-hmm. Citation Award winner, for the Atka Steinberg Award, you know, and just a terrific thing. And that's exactly what we're all about. You know, that a play that might not have had a chance to be produced, we gave it a little life. We gave Jana the opportunity to see the script, and then other folks heard about it and wanted to do it. And it's that play is so important, so important.
Yeah, I think, okay, and just to clarify, this is Gideon's Knot by Jana Adams, which yes. was published in December 2012, mm-hmm. issue of American Theater. Well, when did it play at CATF?
That was the summer before, so July of 2012.
Right, and it's a a contentious parent-teacher
yes.
conference.
Yes,
as
it
you
is.
Would say. And I was actually reading some of the facts about CATF, mm-hmm. and what struck me most was that 40% of your plays are produced by female writers, mm-hmm. and... And is that a conscious decision, or?
It's not actually. I mean, you know, Ed is. We have, you know, Ed Herendeen is. You know, he chooses the season every year, and he's the one who reads the scripts. He eventually brings Peggy and me into the conversation when he sort of narrowed it down. But it's never been a real conscious decision at all. He feels, you know, very strongly that he's going to produce the best plays that he reads in the fall. And we have fallen in within just under 50% of them being by women writers. You know, in our 24 years, we're about to enter our 25th anniversary, we've produced 105 plays, 40 world premieres by about 80 different writers. I'm forgetting the exact number. But, you know, so it's something we're incredibly proud of. Obviously, this is a conversation that's happening nationally right now, and I think it's absolutely fantastic. Right now, as we speak, I think they're about to, in D.C., in our sort of home area, you know, they're doing the big women's theater festival there, mm-hmm. which is fantastic. All those theaters are
committed.
We're not producing in the fall. So
oh, of
we,
course.
So I kind of, I like to tell myself that we're kind of the preamble to that, you know, because we had five plays produced and two of them were by women playwrights. We had two world premieres, Christina Anderson and Chisa Hutchinson, in our lineup this year. So we kind of feel like we kicked it off, you know, that we had some that. But it's fantastic. But for us, we're very proud of it. You know, if those numbers were lower, we might be more adamant to, like, make sure we were. But it sort of happened naturally. I mean, that's come from Ed just reading scripts and finding that those are the ones he wants to do. And we're mm-hmm. and that's what drives us always is the art. And we're going to try to do the best plays we can.
Mm-hmm. And so how many scripts do you read?
Ed will receive between about 100 and 125 every fall. He starts reading in September, and by about November 1, he sort of narrowed it down. He probably has three or four of them selected. But because we produce a rotating repertory, and we also rep a lot of our actors, once we choose two or three of the plays, there's kind of a trickle-down. You have to then start thinking about the casting matrix of it all. So if you have two or three, you know, older African-American women, perhaps, who already know are going to be in these plays, you have to need to start figuring out what's another play that perhaps those actors could be in. So we do start having to sort of fit this puzzle together because of the fact that we do rotating repertory and sort of, and that's not just in terms of them all happening at once, which they do. Our audiences can see all five in 2 days, but it also means that we have to be very conscious of how we cast all those plays and how they sync up to each other.
Oh, so it's a company.
It is each summer. It becomes a company, absolutely. Right. You know, I mean, we have probably the equivalent of, like this past year, probably 20 different roles out there, but we filled that with 13 actors because we had people in rep. So, you know, one person, you know, might have been in The Ashes Under Gate City in the afternoon, say, in one of our theaters, and then later on that evening be in One Night by Charles Fuller, which was another play we produced. So it's all sort of piecing all those things together, which has some, you know, very practical reasons for us to do that. It allows us. But I think the actors love it. Our audiences absolutely love the thrill of seeing an actor in the afternoon and then seeing them in a completely different role in the evening. And it's just sort of part of the energy we like to do down at Shepherdstown.
Right. I mean, does it kind of, not restrict, but does it kind of put like a boundary on what kind of plays you're able to do? Because there's only so big of a scope you can go if you're like, if you're rotating sets every night.
Yeah, I mean, we make it work. You know, we sort of just start, once Ed sort of narrowed it down to maybe 12 scripts, and I think at that point he feels good that he could produce any of those 12. Then we do start thinking about, okay, we have a theater venue that's 416 seats, proscenium, big, wide stage, that we can do a lot of bells and whistles in from a production standpoint, but it's not as intimate as our other two venues. So we have to start thinking about what show will be better up there that maybe can use some of that theatrical element, and what type of show, like Gideon's Knot, to do it in a room that we created a fifth grade classroom, and the audience members sat in fifth grade chairs, and they were within a few feet of that vivid, vivid language that John had put on the page. So we start thinking about all those sorts of things, and start thinking about then what shows sort of work together, what shows would work from a scenic standpoint, because, you know, on Sunday afternoons when we have an early evening performance and a matinee, you know, our crews have about an hour and 15 minutes to change over the entire set. So we have to do start thinking about all that, but I don't think it restricts us because, you know, there are a lot of really good plays out there, and so that I don't think we're losing anything by that. It's just part of the sort of the game we have to play to put it all together.
Right. I mean, would you ever produce like a big splashy musical?
It's not something that I think, I can't speak for Ed Herendeen, but I think in 24 years his aesthetic is fairly well, I think, recognized. You know, we do plays that are provocative. We do plays that I think take a lot of risk. I wouldn't say we do necessarily overtly political plays, but our plays are always about something. And we sort of use this moniker of Think Theater. And it's because we really want to start a conversation with the work on the stage, but we don't ever want to tie it up and make it all nice and neat at the end. We want that conversation to go on for the 48 or 72 hours that our audience members are there seeing the whole experience. We love that every restaurant in Shepherdstown is filled with CATF theater goers, and they're all talking about the work. I love, you know, having these conversations, you know, throughout the weekend with our patrons and watching them debate which one's their favorite play, which ones they couldn't stand, and all these things. And one of my favorite things, you know, I'll hear all this, and, you know, they'll say, I love such and such a play, but I just didn't like this other play. And then they'll talk about the one they didn't like about for a half hour. And I'm like, we got you. That's okay, you know? So it really is about trying to do work that's all that. But the big splashy musical, I don't know that that's going to grace Shepherdstown stages anytime soon. But it's not that our plays aren't entertaining as well, though.
Oh, no, of course not. And I was just wondering if there was a lyricist or a book or a composer who really wanted to send in a script, if that was...
We've certainly done plays in the past with music. You know, we've done some pretty funky things, actually. We did a world premiere play called, you know, You'll Wax Jesus a few years ago that had a lot of different elements going on, you know. So we've certainly done those. You know, budgetarily, it would be hard for us to sort of take on... That the other issue with those sort of bigger things is that the repping system, you know, gets a little bit more complicated. Does that make it more challenging to change the sets in and out? So we definitely have some things we have to think about in that world, but we're open to anything that's about something. You know, we want plays that are going to sort of, you know, help change people a little bit and make them think about the world in a different way.
Right. So I guess that's like the central criteria for for sending in work or choosing work?
Yeah, make sure it's about something. It needs to be important. You know, I mean, I personally, one of the things I've been thinking about a lot is that, you know, we often say, you know, theater can change the world. Well, I think that maybe is a little bit of a tired trope, but I do think that theater can change the people that will go on and change the world. And if we can sort of play a little bit of a role in shedding light on a different perspective in this world of ours, then I feel like we've done our job.
Mm-hmm. No, and I remember like reading a letter someone sent in to us about Gideon's Knot, mm-hmm. or maybe it was a tweet, and they're just talking about how much it upset them, mm-hmm. and I heard that there are tears, and so I guess if that happens, you've done your job.
Absolutely. We had somebody throw up after the production down there, and then we felt sorry for them not feeling very well because they were just so moved, so emotional about it. It's like, come on, if you're getting people, you know, ill because they're so moved, that's got to be great, right? But I remember it was a letter, and what was great, because I remember it was an American Theater a couple issues later on after you published the script, and there were two sort of, there was one letter that was in there that was like, oh my God, this play just is so raw, but so important, and then somebody else who was very much kind of destroyed by it, you know, mm-hmm. and reacted negatively towards it. And that's great. If everybody likes everything we do, we're not doing our job.
Right.
You know, I love it whenever we have five plays, and I can have five different people whose opinion I care about pick a different play to be their quote unquote favorite, then I feel like we've done our job.
Right. Well, you can't be all things to all people.
Cannot. And we never want to be. And if we can do some plays that make folks a little uncomfortable, that's okay too.
And so since you're leaving mm-hmm. in about 2 hours, like mm-hmm. how does the audience in New York compare to your home base in West Virginia?
Well, it's, you know, I haven't, you know, really seen enough of the audience yet. We've had about four or five performances. And I have to say, the final two that I saw, which were on Sunday, was kind of a home field advantage for us. We had a lot of people come up from West Virginia, and a lot of our patrons that live in the New York area came up to celebrate with us. So we kind of had a really, you know, home team audience there. But you know, I think it's interesting. My favorite thing to do, we had a couple plays this summer especially. We did Dead and Breathing by Chisa Hutchinson, which was a play that was really funny, crisp, had a lot of heart, and also really just could be devastating in terms of its topic. But people were instantaneously to their feet every performance, and I just loved going and just watching that moment. You know, that's the reward for me as a producer. And Uncanny Valley was the other one that I always go and sort of just sit and wait and watch people come out. And it was a much quieter ending than Dead and Breathing, and you'd see people's the wheels in their heads sort of spinning, trying to grasp all the things that had just sort of gone on. And what was great was the very first performance down here in New York. Was standing doing that same thing, standing in the lobby, not pretending like I was anybody, and just sort of trying to listen in and to hear people coming out and saying, gosh, that was profound, you know, and or that really, there's something going on there. It seems to be that people are responding to the play the same way they did down in West Virginia. You know, time will tell. I think the New York audience is going to like it, though.
Mm-hmm. And how can people find more information about it?
CATF.org is our main website, www.catf.org. We're in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. We're hosted on the campus of Shepherd University. We're just 70 miles from both Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, Maryland. We're right on the Potomac River. Shepherdstown is the oldest town in West Virginia, doing the newest plays in America. It's this idyllic little hamlet right there. It's beautiful. It's quaint. It's all get out. And then for Uncanny Valley, you know, it runs through October 26th, 5090-59 Theaters. We actually have a special website just for that project. It's catf-nyc.org. There's this terrific 4.5-minute trailer on that site for the play, which you can actually see some of the things we spoke about, how we built the table. Mm-hmm. You can see information on Bina 48, some clips from the show. But really, at the end of the day, we just want people to come out and see the work. It's important.
Yeah. And if they can't come out to New York, then it'll be in California.
It'll be in California and San Diego. It'll be at Philadelphia at Interact Theater. It'll be in California, and then at California again,
yeah.
At Sacramento. So there's a lot of opportunities there for people to see this play, and I think they really will. It's terrific.
Well, thank you, James, for talking to us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us, and congratulations on all the new work you guys are doing.
Thanks.
We love TCG and American Theater. Cheers.
Welcome back. That was a great interview. We're here to recommend things we've seen that you should see, that we've read, heard, thought about. Deep, let's start with you.
Okay, I'm going to recommend Generations by, oh my goodness, her name's...
Debbie Tucker Green?
Yeah, by Debbie Tucker Green, who likes to put her full name in all lowercase.
And the titles of her shows, too.
And the title of her shows. So have fun, any copy
like
editors.
Like Christopher Oscar Pena does that, too.
Katie,
yes, he does.
E.E. Cummings. So does that have anything to do with what you saw in the play, or no?
No, I don't
think like a lowercase play.
Yeah, no, it was definitely wasn't a lowercase play. Though it did make me think of Ebola, but I'm not going to tell you why. So basically, the play's at Soho Rep in the co-production with Play Company, I came in and it was like it's about a family gathering around the kitchen, cooking and talking about cooking and what it means, you know, as a woman, as a husband, as a family, and then. It's the same piece of dialogue, but they repeat it over and over again over a 40-minute period, but it kind of has a new resonance every time they do it. I can't tell you why, because I would spoil the play, but it was just so interesting. It was like kind of an immersive set, and there was like dirt underneath your feet, and you can smell whatever it was they were cooking, like onions and peppers, and it was just, it started off really innocuous, and then got really sad, which is all I'm going to say about that.
I'm going to recommend a show in New York, too, so sorry for our outside the tri-state area listeners, but it's a company that I feel like tours a lot and you should check out. I don't know what they're doing around the country, but I saw the Debate Society's Jacuzzi at Ars Nova this weekend, and the Debate Society is a really interesting company. They've won some Obies. They were at the Sundance Theater Lab. They've done some shows at Williamstown. They did really well with their show Blood Play, which premiered at the Bushwick Star, I think last year, and then was at the Under the Radar Festival at the Public. Really interesting company led by director Oliver Butler and playwright / actors Hannah Boss, I want to say.
Boss,
spelled B-O-S. She's great. And Paul Thurene. And they have a new play, Jacuzzi, which they've been developing for a few years, and they're the company in residence at Ars Nova right now in New York. And it's kind of exactly what you want from the theater and like exactly what you don't want from the theater, because it's an immaculate set in an intimate production. You have a working jacuzzi on stage.
That was the best part,
which is amazing. And I mean, at one point a character splashes the water at the audience and it feels warm, so it's fully working. They're sitting in a jacuzzi on stage.
And you can smell it too.
You can basically smell the chlorine, as I forget who said that in their review, Charles Isherwood. But it's like a thriller set in the early 90s, late 80s. But what's so great about it, and kind of infuriating, but in the best way, is you never actually know what happens or what's going to happen. And you're left with this insane sense of unresolvedness with the play. And yet you're so satisfied because it's answered all the questions in ways you don't know. And, I mean, Hannah and Paul are just... You know, they're great playwrights and they're great actors, which I find is a very, you don't find that often, people that can do both super, super well. It's developed with Oliver and they've, you know, workshopped it over the years. So I'm sure, I don't know exactly what their process is, but I'm sure there's been some devising of it. But all the performances are amazing. The set's brilliant. There's a working jacuzzi. Sit in the front row, you'll get a warm splash. And, you know, follow the Debate Society. They're really a cool company. So check it out. It's at Ars Nova.
I saw in the back row, and I got like a little bit of. I got some sprinkles. It was pretty.
Oh my gosh!
It was pretty.
Well,
cool.
Talking about immersive.
It's only three rows. There's only three rows of audience.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Susie enjoyed it more than I did, of course. But
well, it's frustrating because there's, you know, he doesn't answer all the questions.
Right.
It's not even not answering questions. I'm all for unresolvedness. That's like most of the theater. It kind of has this. I think Charles Isherwood summed it best up in his review, and it was exactly what I felt like it. It had this, there was like this tension because these two people played by Hannah and Paul was so mellow, like to like serial killer level of mellow. And so you expect like there's something is going to go down. And then when it doesn't, like I didn't know what to do with that. And you don't know if something went down or not. That's
but you don't know if something went down or not. I think their serial killer calmness is on purpose because maybe something did go down. Anyway, go see it. It's cool.
Yeah, I gotta say, I find jacuzzis icky, so.
You don't have to sit in it with the
cast
members.
I just don't get it. I'm from Arizona, and jacuzzis, like, you never get in London. It's like you're boiling yourself.
Yeah, it's not the cleanest idea. Yeah,
that's the other thing. But it, probably that works in the show. So this week I want to recommend, you know, this podcast itself is inspired partly by, you know, the podcasts I love to follow, Blogging Heads and the Culture Gab Fest and the Political Gab Fest. And that great one on Slate that Dan Kois does, the Mom and Dad Are Fighting, the parenting podcast, which is exciting for all. But specifically, I'm interested in, you know, there are a number of theater podcasts out there, and we're joining an already crowded field. And I'm going to start a feature this week called Top of the Pods, where I'm going to highlight the various theater podcasts as the new editions come out, and including ourselves. But also, Bernardo Cubrio has one very popular one called Off and On, which is a New York-based. He talks to one artist or group of artists or company each week in a very sort of casual, free-form, friendly discussion. Another one I'm particularly fond of is one called Born Ready, which is in the Bay Area. A guy named Rob Reddy, who has a company called Piano Fight. It's pretty bro-y. I think there's some beer involved when they do their podcast. But there's this guy named Raymond Hobbs he has with him, who's just like this hilarious Owen Wilson-esque sidekick. And they talk so irreverently about some of the stuff that's dearest to us and our readership that it's always a sort of guilty pleasure to listen to them. And they bring up good points, too. Maximu, which is New York-based, they cover a lot of different kinds of theater. They cover comedy. They cover occasionally Broadway. But that's Nicole Serratori, and Lindsay Behrens is the one who runs it, but Nicole's often on it. And that's got a rotating cast of characters, and I enjoy that one. That's a little bit very conversational, almost to a fault. It goes on a bit sometimes, but I always enjoy it. Ones I haven't sampled as much, but I would recommend include Theater Geeks, which is a community theater podcast, but the issues they bring up are all about the stuff that we are interested in, promotion, getting rights to things. And the new one called General Admission in Chicago that was a sort of personal podcast, Tyler Green and Don Hall, and now it's been picked up by WBEZ. So I suggest following all these. Oh, Theater Bay Area has a new one, which we're going to check out as well, Theater Process, that just started with an interview with Mike Daisy. So it's a crowded and interesting field podcast, and I recommend you check out some of these. We'll have a link to that page, Top of the Pods, with our podcast. So without further ado, I think that sums up our week of another week of Off Script.
Thanks so much for joining us.
And visit us at americantheater.org.